Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of Crazy Money. It is a great day to be alive. I'm happy you're here with me. I've got a great guest to share with you today, and he's going to speak basically on that truth that it is a great day to be alive, that every day is a great day to be alive. Every day is a great day to be healthy, to be happy, to be mindful, to be grateful, to be productive, to be the best you that you can be. His name is Robin Sharma. He is a leadership expert, coach, and author whose books have sold tens of millions of copies around the world. I bet you a dollar you've read or at least heard of one of his several books, including The 5 A.M. Club, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, The Everyday Hero Manifesto, and Who Will Cry When You Die. Robin has a new book out called The Wealth Money Can't Buy, in which he examines all the way that we can develop our personal fulfillment, our happiness, our productivity, but most specifically, ways that we can develop mindfulness about all the forms of wealth in our life, not just the financial. In this conversation, Robin shares with me insights from his new book, including the danger of focusing solely on money, how to find joy in your craft, no matter what it is, what his work with billionaires has taught him about money and life, why and how he started writing, whether he believes in God, where the word coach comes from, the benefits of mastery, and the eight forms of wealth, which include wellness, family, craft, money, community, adventure, and service. This guy is a very accomplished human being, and we all could learn a lot from him. Please enjoy this conversation with Robin Sharma.
My voice is a little shot, but I think we should be okay.
Good.
So it's great to meet you.
Where are you today?
I'm in Italy.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah, the farmhouse that you mention in the book.
That is it. Yeah, I'm right in the writing room.
You paint a lovely picture.
It's very quiet, you know, it's very quiet here.
Why did you pick Italy?
The people are amazing. The food is great. The scenes are fantastic. It's a great place to be.
I wouldn't argue with you based on my two trips to Italy. It's pretty wonderful.
It really is.
I enjoyed a lot of the settings you painted in the book, including the musical references. Like, I had heard of Greta Van Fleet many times, but I'd never really checked them out. And I turned them on while I was driving and listening to the book. That guy sounds like Robert Plant.
Well, I think that's the thing about Greta Van Fleet. People do compare them to Led Zeppelin. I think Robert Plant even said they're very good. You know, he took it very graciously.
And he said, you cannot miss the comparison.
He's a pretty good Robert Plant, said Robert Plant.
Somebody said, I think that's what Roger McGuinn said about one of Tom Petty's songs. He goes, when did I record this?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I think they collaborated at some point.
They did. Yeah, they did. One or two albums at the end. Have you ever seen that Tom Petty documentary that Peter Bogdanovich did, The Running Down a Dream?
I adore that documentary. It is an incredible documentary.
I've watched it probably 15 times. Are you a comedy fan?
It depends on if it's a great comedy. I have to enjoy it for sure.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and get to know you a little bit. I spent a lot of hours with you in your new book. Tell me a little bit more and tell our listeners a little bit more. Who is Robin Sharma?
Well, first of all, you have to forgive me, Paul, for my voice. So thank you for your patience. I'm a family man. I'm a writer. I do a lot of presentations around the world. I mentor a lot of ultra successful people, and I'm a human being pursuing a craft and on a mission to try to help people remember their primal talents and do amazing things with their lives.
When and why did you start writing?
Well, I think I almost couldn't not write, if that makes sense to you. I mean, right now, writing is my oxygen. So I used to be a litigation lawyer. I was successful, but deeply unfulfilled.
What kind of litigation? Are we corporate or personal liability, that kind of thing?
It was for the Canadian Justice Department, actually. I achieved a lot, but I would wake up every morning and feel very empty. And so, long story short, I went on a bit of an odyssey to try to find more joy in my life, more meaning in my life, a greater sense of purpose, satisfaction. And I learned a lot of different modalities, talked to a lot of interesting people, learned a lot of great ideas, and decided I was going to write a book called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And people laughed at the idea. Not many people gave me much of a chance. They said, are you kidding me? You're going to leave this law profession to become a writer? What do you know about writing? But I self-published a book called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And interestingly, or maybe not interestingly, but people started reading the book. And through word of mouth, the book became a phenomenon, which led to more books, which led me to you, Paul.
To this very moment.
To this very moment.
Which is all that we have. Which is all that
which
we have.
Which is all. Isn't that true, though?
I think it's something that we need to focus on more, each of us. Because, you know, and you talk about this a little bit in the book, it's that this is, you know, that yesterday doesn't matter. Tomorrow is might not come. And so why not take this very moment to savor life?
Well, it sounds like such a, yes, cliche, live in the moment. But I think that's what the last few years have done for a lot of people. They've caused us to live to the point. They've caused us to be less busy being busy. They've caused us to rethink our priorities. I would even perhaps say connecting to our mortality is a great source of inspiration. No one likes talking about mortality and the shortness of life, but I think it's very powerful. Most mornings I do 5 questions as part of my journaling process. I write down, what am I grateful for? I write down, where am I winning? So I can get some micro wins to fuel some momentum and energy. 3, I write down, what will I let go of today? I think that's a very powerful question. So we don't be what I call in the wealth money can't buy, so we don't become resentment collectors. 4th question, what does my ideal day look like? And 5th question, what do I want said about me at the end of my life? That 5th question is quite powerful, because if we can connect with the mortality of life, you know, maybe get a little micro emotion around what do we want the people who are most important to us to say about how we lived. I think then we stop playing with our phones all day. We stop chasing trivial pursuits. We stop betraying ourselves by saying yes to things that we really don't want to. And we live to the point. I think, you know, that's the point, to live to the point.
What are some examples of things that you let go of on a daily basis?
Well, I think in life we all get disappointed from time to time. I think that's a fair statement, hopefully. I think people can disappoint us in business. People can disappoint us personally. And I think it's very easy not to let go of those people and not to process through and metabolize the resentment or hurt or disappointment we might have. I think that's human nature. But I think if you don't release that disappointment, let's call it, sometimes it's anger. If we don't release it, Paul, then it builds within us. And for all the entrepreneurs and financiers that follow you, they might say, well, how is this relevant? Well, I think it's very relevant. All of that baggage we accumulate that we pretend is not there, that we do not release, affects our creativity, our productivity, our energy, our prosperity, and the way we roll through life.
On a spectrum of non-attachment to forgiveness, where does that land?
Well, I think it's both. I think letting go of the things that are keeping you down is an act of non-attachment, and I think it's an act of forgiveness. Forgiveness is in many ways letting go of the people you're carrying with you on your back, right?
Yeah.
So how can we do our greatest work? How can we build great companies? How can we handcraft great lives if we've got 15 people we're carrying with us metaphorically through life with us on our backs?
You've sold over 20 million books around the world. What are people looking for when they pick up a new work by you?
A lot of different things. Some people are at the top of the mountain. They're billionaires. They want another few billion. Some people are in the valley of darkness and they want a little bit of maybe joy or how to get through the pain. Some people want to launch a startup. Some people want to run a marathon. Some people want love. Some people want to make a masterpiece. I write about all of those things. In the Wealth Money Can't Buy, as you know, it's built on a foundation, which is, I think, fairly disruptive. I know your podcast is the Crazy Money Podcast. Our world has taught us in many ways that wealth is a lot of money. Wealth is a big portfolio. Wealth is a house or multiple houses. What I'm suggesting in this book is wealth is one of the forms of wealth. Puts food on the family table, allows you to do great things for yourself and your family, allows you not to be backed into the corner and make choices that you don't want to make. But it's only one of the eight forms of wealth, which is a model I've been teaching to my billionaire professional sports star entertainment royalty clients for 15 years. It's one of the eight forms of wealth. So there's a lot of people who are cash rich, but life poor. And this book really offers a model and then a series of tools and methods to help people live all eight forms of wealth so they become truly rich.
Hello, everyone. We'll be right back with Robin Sharma in just one moment. But first, I want to let you know that I'm doing comedy live in person somewhere near you or near a friend of yours whom you should tell about my show. Here goes April 12th. That's this Friday. Well, depending upon when you listen to it. April 12th, 2024 at the Laughing Skull Lounge in Atlanta, Georgia. Both the 8 and the 10:30 shows. April 18th, I'll be hosting for Jay Lawson from Los Angeles, California at the Atlanta Athletic Club in Johns Creek, Georgia. April 19th and 20th, two shows each night at the DC Comedy Loft with my pal Paul Pravar, our Two Pauls, One Show show. May 3rd and 4th, two shows Friday, three shows Saturday at the Denver Comedy Lounge. I will be headlining. May 17th, the Cary Theater in Cary, North Carolina. The next night, we're driving west to Greensboro, North Carolina for a show at the Idiot Box Comedy Club. Both the Cary Theater and Idiot Box shows are Two Pauls, One Show show. May 24th through 26th, I'm at the Vail Comedy Festival. June 20th, Off the Hook Comedy Club, Two Pauls, One Show. June 21st and 22nd, I'll be featuring for Paul Farvar at the Vero Beach Comedy Zone. That's it, folks. Lots of good stuff coming up. We'll be in Dallas in September. Mark your calendars, kid. Back to Robin Sharma. I'll list those forms that you lay out in the book. They're growth, wellness, family, craft, money, community, adventure, and service. Let's start with craft.
Interesting place to start.
Well, I think about it all the time. I think about it every day. I'm a former corporate guy who became a stand-up comedian and podcaster and writer. I'm trying to use the hours of my day to express my identity. But I wonder, you're an attorney who became a writer. Do you have to be an artist to have a craft, or can you practice craft as a professional services person?
Well, I would actually start that answer by saying we all can be artists no matter what we do. What is an artist? An artist is someone who creates magic. An artist is someone who is creative. You can be a mother, a father, a grandma, taxi driver, financial planner, astronaut, CEO, and be an artist. You can be a barista. Nine people are complaining. The 10th one has a sparkle in her eyes and works like Basquiat painted. You've seen those people. You go to a hotel. Many people are checked out, but that one person goes, I want to go the extra mile and be a merchant of wow. So I think we all can be artists. I think when we were kids, we were all artists. And then the world, you know, Einstein, Paul, said, never lose your holy curiosity. And I think we are born into genius and we get resigned into ordinary. And I think we are all are born artists. But yes, on that fifth form of wealth, craft, I think it's a gorgeous opportunity to see our jobs not only as a job, but as a craft that we pursue. I mean, the pursuit of mastery, no matter what you do, is a wealth. It's a currency. Even if no one notices it, Van Gogh only sold two paintings in his lifetime, but he spent his entire lifetime pursuing his craft. He didn't do it for the applause. He did it because of the way it made him feel, the pursuit of beauty.
So what do you say to that late career professional who feels stuck in a rut at the accounting firm or the consulting firm? Their clients are halfway around the country or around the globe. They're doing it because they got to pay for their kids' college or a lifestyle that they've already committed to. How do they find the art in the everyday of their job?
They find the art in the everyday of their job. They look for it. They stop complaining. They stop blaming. take their work seriously. They go back to school to take more courses, even though they're, you said late stage, 50, 60, 70. The thing about a master is they think like a beginner. They go to classes, they get a mentor. They go the extra mile. They innovate. They learn to communicate in different ways. They learn fresh accounting ways, if that's possible. They play with their game. They're willing to fail. They take the difficult projects. And if after all that, they say, oh, I'm still not fulfilled, they find something else. We have so many more choices than we might see. You know what? I've tried to see my accounting job as a craft. I'm not fulfilled. I've really given my best, but my heart wants me to be a comedian. They go do stand-up. They model the best. They study the masters. They read all the books. How common is this? It's not very common. But seeing your work as a craft is so incredibly powerful, no matter what you do. What Martin Luther King Jr. has a quote, even if you sweep streets, sweep like Michelangelo painted, so all the gods in heaven say, there goes a great street sweeper. It's really powerful. And don't just do it for the world and the people you inspire. Do it for how it makes you feel when your head hits the pillow every night.
Perhaps a related concept is something you say that I found interesting. The doorway to success swings inward, not outward. What does that mean?
Well, it means the first form of wealth in the wealth money can't buy, growth. I don't think it's very common to say, wow, Paul, you're growing, you're reading, you're meditating, you're praying, you're journaling, you've got mentors, you've released the energy vampires from your life. You've got all these great habits and rituals. Fantastic. Every day you're growing a little bit. You're rich. It's not common. But to build intimacy with your finest self, to know your strengths, to become wiser every day, to release your insecurities, to move towards being more fearless, to become the highest version of your greatest vision, that's worth all the money in the world.
Do you think most people get stuck in this rut because they're focused on money? Because they're making decisions that optimize wealth as opposed to optimize financial wealth as opposed to these other forms of wealth?
Yes, I think society has programmed us very deeply in many, if not most cases, to measure our worth by net worth financially, to measure how we're doing by the scoreboard of how much money we have or how many material things we have. I want to be super clear in this book. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with gathering beautiful material things and making a lot of money. As a matter of fact, the fifth form of wealth is money. And there's 25 chapters where I've deconstructed exactly how the billionaires think, what they do, how they build their fortunes. I really do think a lot of people are chasing a mountain of so-called success that I think when they get to the top or halfway up, they'll go, it didn't make any difference. I was in Los Angeles last week, and I think about Jim Carrey, the Hollywood legend. Great comedian. You talk about comedians. Great comedian. And he said, I wish everyone could be rich and famous to realize it didn't make a difference. It didn't make a difference. We really do think if I had a million, 10 million, 50 million, 100 million, a billion, my problems would go away. Let's be honest. Some of them might, but it's not going to fill the holes and the emptiness inside of you, because as the Zen proverb says, wherever you go, there you are.
What else has your work with billionaires taught you about money? Or what would you like to share that they know that other people should know that would help them in one form or fashion?
Well, I would say don't lose your health on the way to wealth, financial wealth. Many of them are very fit. They understand the linkage between being fit and income and impact.
Is that because they want to live longer because they want to enjoy how much money they have? I mean, if I was a billionaire, I'd want to live to 150, right?
You know, online, there's a lot of billionaires who are biohacking and trying to extend life. And a lot of them are very much into longevity. I think for some of them, it's they want to enjoy their wealth, financial wealth more. And I think for some of them, they want to have more of an impact. So some of the traps, though, I know a lot of billionaires that I have advised and they've lost their families along the way. They have the jets and the yachts, but their children won't speak to them anymore. Many of them have all the material things in the world and they feel like imposters. Many of them have built huge financial fortunes and they've made their lives so complicated that they don't have any peace. I think peace of mind is the new luxury good. You know, in the beginning of the book, I say the happiest person I've ever met, my ski instructor. He said, Robin, going up the chairlift one day, this man with rosy cheeks who loved what he did, family who adored him, do nice barbecues every night,
yeah,
teach people how to ski. He goes, Robin, us ski instructors, we're not rich, but we have rich lives. There's a lot of wisdom there.
There's a ski instructor, I believe he's in Deer Valley, and he's probably 80. And he's got a beautiful head of gray hair, and he looks like the healthiest, happiest guy on the planet. And that's what he does. He spends his day skiing and being with people who are happy to be where they're at.
I think part of success is just living life on your own terms, you know, unplugging from the matrix, not following the herd, and living life on your own terms versus your neighbor's life or the life social media wants you to live. And that's why these eight forms of wealth in the Wealth Money Can't Buy, I think, are so helpful. Money's one of them, but growth, wellness, family. What's the point of making a fortune and being all alone? I'm going to see my dad in a few days. My dad's going to be 87. My mom's in her 80s. Like, what? How much is that worth? Hanging out with your parents, having great friends. Like I said in the book, you know, a friend that you could call at 3 a.m. from a foreign country and he'd hop on a plane and be there for you. That is a rich person. I mean, you're rich to have that kind of a friend.
Yeah. You talk about the rewards of mastery being money, power, /influence, and freedom. You seem to have created a life of mastery. Which of those things brings you the most joy?
Well, I don't know if I said... I think I said those are worldly rewards.
Mm.
I believe many people look at mastery and it brings FFA, fame, fortune, and applause. But I believe there's something much deeper. I believe the true masters pursue JPF, joy, peace, and freedom. Mm. Joy, peace, and freedom. Sorry, but what was your question around
that? Which of those things that you seem to have created, you know, a lot of the book is you talking about like, look, this is how I've constructed my life. These are the practices that bring me the opportunity to work the way I want to work, with whom I want to work, where I want to work, and in the way I want to do it. So you've achieved this kind of personal and professional mastery. Which of those things, money, power, and I apologize, I got that quote wrong. Perhaps it was a different angle I was taking on that. But which of those things really brings you the most satisfaction?
Well, I don't think I've achieved mastery.
You're striving towards mastery, certainly.
Paul, I think that's such a key point. I think I never want to lose the beginner's mindset.
Right.
I think that's the dangerous thing about thinking you're an expert. You fall in love with your winning formula and you fall in love with the dogma and the principles that you believe are truths. And then some 17-year-old sees the world through a different set of eyes and knocks you out of the game. So, right? Like, that's the danger.
We've seen it a few times in our lifetime.
Look at a lot of corporate titans. Look at a lot of professional athletes. I've mentored a lot of professional athletes, NBA stars. The moment you actually think you're a superstar, it's a human tendency. You start resting on your laurels. You miss practices. You party too much. You make the wrong decisions.
Tell that Kobe Olympic story.
I have to tell you. So there's the Olympic story. And the Olympic story comes from, what was the name of the documentary? Dream Team, I think. I think it's called Dream Team. Excuse me, Paul. It's the Redeem Team.
Okay.
The Redeem Team. So it was... Team USA, and eventually they brought Kobe on board because they wanted to win, and they were in whatever country the Olympics were at. They were out partying all night, you know, and having fun and bonding before the next day's practice at 11 o'clock. And as they show up at the hotel, this is Team USA, 4 o'clock in the morning, They're all partying in the elevator. And who walks in dripping with sweat, giving them an eye? It's Kobe. And he clearly had been working out. And he didn't say a word. He just stared at them. And they got the point. And slowly and steadily, each one of them through the week stopped partying and getting up early and putting in the effort. And I think Kobe Bryant is a great example of someone who understands that the thing about a master is they always think they're a beginner. So what drives me in this pursuit of mastery? And that's only one of the eight forms of wealth. I'm not suggesting my whole life is this obsession with my craft, but on that fourth form of wealth, what pursues me is not money. It's not really applause and fame. I'm a private person. I like being at home with my family here in my old farmhouse. What drives me is serving my readers. This is year 31. I've been writing these books like the 5 AM Club and this new book. It's year 31. My readers count on me. They don't want me to mail it in. They don't want me to run a winning formula. Every book has to be better than the last. What drives me is my parents' name is on the front cover. I've got to honor their good name. What drives me is to see how far I can get. I think that's the real reward. If you've got me on this idea about mastery and craft, and I love it. But I think the real reward is the silent reward. Who you get to become in a world where people see their job as a job. Who you get to become by going, I'm a London taxi driver, like when I met 2 weeks ago, who vacuums after every guest. He vacuums and he Windexes the windows. And he's like Mr. Professional. And he's, you know, I mean, it's like you had the most important job in the world because it was the most important job to him. So I think that's how you enter the secret universe of the great ones. Whatever you do, you do it to the best of your abilities. You're not entitled. You don't expect the world to owe you a living. You go out there and you live your talents and you model mastery and you treat people with respect and you do all those other things I talk about in the book, build a great family life, all those 20 plus chapters on wellness and energy and longevity. I think about the seventh form of wealth, adventure. I mean, if you have a life of adventure, a life of learning, a life of fascination and all those tools I talk about in the different chapters, I think that's wealth. The last section, the eighth form of wealth, service. To live your life in, I mean, one of the great billionaires on the planet, this isn't all about billionaires at all, but Ted Turner, he once quoted in an interview, the founder of Rotary, the service club, Paul Harris, and he said, the one who serves the best profits the most. So if you're an entrepreneur pushing magic and great value into a marketplace, being generous versus scarce, treating people well, being a merchant of wow, that's a form of wealth.
Where does the word coach come from?
It comes from this idea of a stage coach. And it's a vehicle who takes you from one place to another place. And that's what a good coach or a good mentor does. They take you from where you now are to a place where you want to go. They transport you.
And how do you put that in practice with your clients?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that come to mind to answer that intelligent question. I would say in this book, everyone who's reading it, I'm trying to mentor them. I'm trying to remind them of their gifts and talents. I'm trying to remind them of the difference between busy and productivity and movement and progress in this world where so many of us are distracted and spinning our wheels. Through the book, I'm trying to mentor people on a philosophy and a methodology about real wealth with these eight forms of wealth. When I coach clients in a business setting, it all depends on where they want to go, like that stagecoach. Some want better health. So we look at their habits and their routines. We put in place a great morning routine. I think it's one of the central pieces to a fantastic life. You know, I wrote that book, The 5 a.m. Club, getting up before the rest of the world, training yourself to get up early. And it's not at all about hustle and grind. It's about getting up early to give yourself some time to work out, to read, to pray, to meditate, to study, to paint, to walk, to be silent, to reflect. So that as you go through the day, the tone of your day is different. You're living the day on your terms. So there's all sorts. Some clients come to me because they want a greater financial fortune. So we look at their team. We look at their strategy. We look at their products. We look at their suppliers. We look at the way they're running their business.
Is part of that really helping them articulate what they want?
It's part of it. Clarity breeds mastery. If you don't know your personal Mount Everest, you could spend the best hours of your finest days climbing the wrong mountains. It sounds so simple, but clarity breeds mastery. Vague plans lead to vague results. So few of us know our top five values, for example. I'm not judging, I'm just reporting. But if you don't know your values, you don't have a decision matrix to run your day and your business and your life. But if you know your values, maybe it's honesty, maybe it's integrity, maybe it's beauty, maybe it's creativity, maybe it's authenticity, then you get to live your values if you choose. Maybe one of your values in business, if you've articulated, is what I call in the book, the 10X value obsession, to give your customers 10 times the value than they have any right to expect. Well, that becomes a decision matrix for your client service and the way you create products. They've got to be beautiful. They've got to wow people. They can't just be ordinary. Maybe one of your values is simplicity. Okay, I know the value. Got clarity on it. You strip out the complexity. You have three great friends versus 10,000 digital friends. You master one book versus reading 50 books. You sell a lot of your possessions, but the ones you have are the highest quality. But clarity is very important.
How have the challenges that you've overcome in your life, how do they inform the work that you do today?
Well, Paul, I've learned the most from my most painful experiences. I really hope this book, for example, is honest and real and helpful and sincere. And I think the more we suffer, the more real we become. The more pain we experience, the more we see everyone we meet as a fellow brother or sister on this small planet. The more pain we experience, the more we do live to the point. The more we appreciate the small graces, the more we don't hold back, the more we fear less about rejection and what people think of us. I think pain, there's an idea, which is a bad day for the ego is a great day for the soul. And I think that's a true point. You know, the things that break us or attempt to break us, or you know, those difficulties we all experience through life serve us very, very, very well. They introduce us to our strengths. They introduce us to our values. They show us how strong we are and what we can endure. It's a wealth money can't buy.
For someone who's really hurting right now, where would you direct their attention inside the book?
I would direct their attention to some of the tools I talk about on dealing with adversity, such as MVP. We know, sports lovers know, that MVP is most valuable player. MVP is an acronym I use for meditation, visualization, and prayer. And there's lots of great science showing the power of meditation to become more resilient and the power of neuroplasticity. Meditation allows us to rewire and reprogram our thinking. So I would say, number one, anyone who's going through a painful time, using meditation and visualization and prayer is very powerful. A lot of scientists these days saying, I didn't believe in prayer, but when I need to feel stronger, I pray and it actually works. Isn't that interesting? So I would say MVP. Number two, I talk a little bit about in the book about journaling. In my difficult times, I've journaled about how I feel, about my confusion. I've journaled about a better future. Journaling is very powerful. Pouring out your frustration or disappointment on a clear white page is very healing. For anyone going through a difficult time, I would also say this too shall pass. It's a very ancient proverb. but no one spends the rest of their life in the winter. We have winters, we have summers, we have spring. Life is a series of seasons. For anyone going through pain, I would also say stay in it. Such counterintuitive advice. Stay in it, because in that pain is where you grow. And that growth is priceless. That growth is priceless. What you learn about yourself, the wisdom. I mean, what do we learn in painful times, Paul? How to forgive, how to understand. We learn patience. We learn patience. We learn resilience. We learn what's most important. These are priceless currencies that difficulty teaches us if we decide to not play the victim.
You mentioned prayer. Do you believe in God?
I do, yes.
What's God look like to you?
I've never seen God, so I can't tell you.
You know what I mean. How do you imagine God?
I don't imagine God. I think you're one of the first people who've ever asked me about that, but I don't imagine God as an image. For me, it's a presence. It's a presence. It's a strong presence. Yeah, and one thing I would say, and I'm not presenting myself or hopefully, you know, that I have all the answers and I'm some kind of a guru, you know.
We're just having a conversation here, man.
You know? Yeah, I just want to be clear on that. I've got, you know, I'm just on my journey here. It's remarkable to me how the more good you try to put out, the more people you try to help, and the more you, yeah, just be helpful to people, whether it is through your work or through your words or through your acts or through your life, good things come back to you. You know, and you can call it God or you can call it the universe, but I just think this world has a very fair accounting system. And I know what a lot of people might say, well, no, and you know, people betray you. And I've heard that. But sooner or later, good things come to people who do good things. And I think that's just I think right now our world needs us to be more generous. And I think a lot of business people and a lot of human beings are hurt. They don't feel the world is a safe place. And so they're in scarcity. And so they're not giving as much. There's chapters in the seventh form of wealth on adventure, where I talk about the fact that, you know, be a gift giver and don't expect a reward, because then it's not a gift. It's a barter. It's a contract. But I think it's just really powerful every day. Just go out there and give gifts to people. Maybe it's a sincere compliment. Maybe it's work that's beautiful. Maybe it's a physical gift. Maybe it's a good tip to a hotel room housekeeper who does a difficult job, but a very important one.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Let's leave people with the idea of giving gifts and leading with kindness, as you talk about in the book as well.
Sure.
The book is called The Wealth Money Can't Buy, by my guest, Robin Sharma. Robin, where can people find out more about your work?
Well, the internet, they can just search my name at Robin, Sharma. The Wealth Money Can't Buy is on Audible, Amazon, and all good bookstores. And I'm on Instagram and YouTube and all the usual places, Paul.
Well, congrats on the new book. I hope it helps millions and millions of people.
You're very kind. I thank you for your time, and I appreciate you. Have a good day.
I want to extend my gratitude to Robin Sharma for taking time out of an incredibly busy schedule and share insights into his writing, his work, his life, and his consulting to the high-profile individuals that he works with on a regular basis. I should have asked him who some of those folks were. Yeah, would that be a little intrusive? Maybe. Maybe he would have shared some. I don't know. I'm glad I asked about God. I thought that was pushing the limits a little bit, and I thought his answer was interesting. I do like the fact that nobody else has ever asked him that, according to him, and I think these are good conversations to have. You want to have the context of someone's beliefs behind the writing and their advice and their guidance, so you know where they're coming from when they're telling you how to live your life. Speaking of God, my guest next week is a fantastic one, and I'm very excited to meet him. His name is Rabbi Steve Leader. He's the senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, California. It is a large and influential congregation, and Steve is their shepherd. And he's written several books. The one I read is called The Beauty of What Remains, and it's a touching memoir. Well, it's a portion of a memoir anyway. It's a touching account of the death of his father, his prolonged death from Alzheimer's, and how Steve processed his profound grief. And so we're going to talk a lot about death. We're going to talk about the deaths of our respective fathers. My father's been dead almost 4 years. Hard to believe. He died right in the middle of COVID. That was the end of it for him. Honestly, I think he was hanging in there pretty good. And then when he was alone for a few months, he's just like, check, please. I'm done. Anyway, I miss my dad. Steve misses his dad profoundly. So we're going to be two sons talking about the loss of their fathers. And we're also going to talk about how Jews deal with death, both from a tradition standpoint, from a practices standpoint, from a prayer standpoint, and from a cultural standpoint. And certainly there's a lot of death going on in Israel lately, and there's a long, brutal history of death to the Jewish people. So we're going to talk about that, and it's going to be a great conversation. And if you want to catch up on it before I talk to him, read The Beauty of What Remains by Steve Leder, L-E-D-E-R. We'll be back with him next week. In the meantime, Mike Carano, make me sound smart.